From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race and Democracy.
Is the current surge in hospitalizations around the country due to the fact that we are simply testing more people?
When you're looking at the African American community and the minority community in general as a demographic group, there are two elements that make it much more difficult for them and why they're suffering disproportionately.
Commissioner, you also understand there has to be a level of trust. The police depend upon the general public. And right now, unfortunately, that trust has been harmed as a result of some of the videos that have been shown online.
There is this browning of America, and there is going to be a power shift to those who traditionally have been sort of violently removed from power.
COVID, Race, and Democracy. Today's edition is presented by Pacifica Radio's WBAI in New York. I'm Gloria J. Brown Marshall, your host. In today's program, we hear pushback from vulnerable members of our society disproportionately affected by COVID-19. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Sue Goodwin. The U.S. broke its record for the highest coronavirus cases recorded in a single day, with over 36,000 new positives reported Wednesday. The top three states with the most infections, more than 5,000 each, are Texas, Florida, and California. Nationwide, cases are up 30% compared to the beginning of this month. Here's how some governors are responding to the pandemic. In Texas today, Governor Greg Abbott issued an executive order suspending elective procedures in hospitals in four counties to free up space for virus patients. In California, Governor Newsom is threatening to withhold up to $2.5 billion in the upcoming state budget from local governments that fail to comply with state mandates on wearing masks, testing, and other measures. And on Wednesday, the governors of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut issued a travel advisory warning people arriving from states with high rates of coronavirus to quarantine for 14 days or face heavy fines. The Trump administration announced on Wednesday that it would stop sending financial support to 13 coronavirus testing centers at the end of this month, despite the continued spread of the disease. More than half the states impacted by the move are in Texas. Republican Senators John Cornyn and Ted Cruz said now was not a time to retreat from the testing sites and urged federal authorities to extend support for the locations in Texas. And there's growing evidence that face masks can be effective in slowing the spread of COVID-19. A new projection from the University of Washington says nearly 180,000 Americans will die from coronavirus by October 1st. But that number would drop by 30,000 if 95% of Americans started wearing masks in public. And an analysis by the Philadelphia Inquirer shows states that don't require masks are seeing a major spike in new coronavirus cases. In the 16 states where wearing face masks in public is not mandatory, new coronavirus cases have risen by 84%. Over the last 2 weeks, the Inquirer reported. Trump continues to claim that people only wear masks to protest him. Calls are growing for the city of Aurora, Colorado, to conduct a new investigation into the death last year of Elijah McClain. He was a 23-year-old African-American massage therapist who died after being tackled by police and placed in a chokehold and then being injected with ketamine by paramedics. McClain was stopped by three police officers in August of 2019 as he was walking home from a convenience store. Police claimed he was acting suspicious. He died on August 30th after days on life support. On Wednesday, Colorado Governor Jared Polis announced the state would review the case. And the police chief in Tucson, Arizona, has offered to resign following the death of a man in police custody, 27-year-old Carlos Ingram Lopez, died on April 21st after police pinned him face down to the ground for 12 minutes. His family had called the police because the man was drunk and running around the house naked. In a police body cam video, Carlos Ingram Lopez can be heard asking for water and his grandmother. At one point, he says, "I can't breathe. I'm Sue Goodwin."
Trump announced an authorization, quote, effective immediately, to arrest anyone caught destroying or vandalizing a commemoration to a former member of the armed services on federal land. Protesters tried and failed to topple a statue of former President Andrew Jackson near the White House. Jackson enslaved black people as a plantation owner and is remembered for the Trail of Tears, a forced removal of Native Americans from the South that led to thousands of deaths.
We've arrested numerous people, as you know, for what took place outside of Washington. In addition, the FBI is investigating hundreds of people throughout the country for what they've done to monuments, statues, and even buildings. So we have very strong laws already on the books. I mean, we have a law that's 10 years. It's 10 years. That's a long time to have fun one night. I think many of the people that are knocking down these statues don't even have any idea what the statue is, what it means, who it is. When they knock down Grant, when they want to knock down Grant, but when they look at certain, now they're looking at Jesus Christ, they're looking at George Washington, they're looking at Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson. Not going to happen. Not going to happen. Not as long as I'm here.
Trump comes amid nationwide protests of racial inequality that have brought down dozens of statues in recent weeks, most depicting Confederate leaders or historic U.S. figures with ties to past racist policies. I'm Amara Evering. Stay safe.
COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily broadcast by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates. You can listen and download the show from the website covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Tell a friend about it. It will be worth it.
This is Gloria J. Brown Marshall. We're going now to Dr. Terrence Ruth, an advocate for public education, serving as a teacher, principal, and parent. And now, please, give us a perspective on the protests and what's needed. What do people want to make the changes that need to take place?
Now, it's a pleasure to be here, and it's a very wonderful question, because what we're experiencing here in the South, in particular in North Carolina, is we are seeing really a compounded sort of stacking of injustice. And the expression that we're seeing in the streets is no longer political leaders that give lip service. We are seeing local community activists and organizers really put pressure on what does it mean to create a new narrative. So they want action steps. They want to see change legislation. They want to see new leadership. They want to see emboldened and empowered leadership that can actually address the injustice of history. And you're actually, in North Carolina, you're actually seeing where universities, elementary schools, middle schools are changing their names within the last days. They changed their names from individuals who supported or were active white supremacists to schools that promoted the historical narrative of black leaders and black business leaders in North Carolina. So you're seeing a movement and a voice that's calling for action, and it's actually refreshing to see the young voices taking charge of this time.
With the ongoing protests around not just the murder of George Floyd, there's something else there. Can you describe what you think it is?
Yes. So there's a narrative that links together, I call it the default negative principle, that by default, my pigmentation produces fear in you. By default, even with a PhD, my pigmentation tells you that I am unintelligent by default. So these default negatives that we are seeing has infiltrated our schools, and I'm coming from a school background that's also a mirror of policing in poor and black and brown communities. So now you're hearing a challenge in the school system around what does it mean to remove police officers out of schools. And now that's also mirroring what we're hearing in the streets. They're saying we need more accountability. If we can't trust police officers and actually everyone in the criminal justice system to act upon the benefit of the community, either they be black or brown, knowing that there's a default negative that actually birthed policing and actually birthed the criminal justice system as we see it. And so that's why you're hearing so many narratives around reform. If we can't trust them to act on behalf of black and brown and all people in community, then we must have an additional accountability. And that's why I stood with my friend and my brother, Investigator Manning in New York, around the Department of Civilian Justice bill proposal. He worked with Serpico, and he also worked with several other just great thinkers around criminal justice reform. And we're taking a three-pronged approach in North Carolina. So we're addressing grass tops, grassroots, and sort of political levers. So we are sitting on a hotbed of organizers and activists and community leaders who are moving across the state.
Where are we as far as realizing just how dangerous this country is for African Americans?
Well, it's a really good question because I see there's two things. I want to talk to just the narrative and the timeline that you gave of lynchings. And over the weekend, there was a group of protesters who took down a statue in our downtown Raleigh area that represented the Confederate and white supremacist leaders or leadership. And they hung that statue from a light pole. And the outcry against that movement or against that decision floored me, because that was a statue of materials put together to resemble somebody. But the outcry against lynchings that actually existed, with human beings no longer could breathe another second. And how can we have an emotional response to somebody who, at least in history, there's evidence that they supported the lynching and killing of many black people, and we're having an emotional response of anger at their statue hanging from a light pole? And that, to me, was just flooring for our city. It was flooring for those who felt that we've moved beyond the violence against black and brown lives. I do think that we are moving to a point where there is this browning of America, and there is going to be a power shift to those who traditionally have been sort of violently removed from power. And so I think there's a backlash fear to that transition. Also, we are seeing where research has shown that the millennial, which you're seeing protests in the street, the millennial and younger generations, they are growing up in an environment where their virtual community, their both virtual spaces, is occupied more than their physical spaces. And so how are we transitioning this conversation? How are we informing this group, this younger group, when they transition to this primarily virtual community where lynchings primarily happen in physical spaces? How are we transferring that information so that they can know what do a lynching look like in virtual spaces? And so there's going to be a pivoting conversation. I still think that there's deep-rooted pain and trauma that our country is still running from. And my hope is that those who are protesting in the street, who are mixed with different colors, can help us address this horrendous history face on.
Thank you so much, Dr. Terrence Ruth. Take care and be safe.
Thank you.
And you're listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, brought to you today by WBAI New York. I'm Gloria J. Brown Marshall. Continuing with the theme of pushback against reform, Milton Alamadi, WBAI host and editor of Black Star News, spoke with New York City's First Lady Charlene McRae.
I just wanted to start with a broad overview, maybe, to ask you this. Since the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis by ex-police officer Derek Chauvin, the nation has been experiencing convulsions. We're seeing the protests, demonstrations, and even internationally. Do you think we are at a unique point once again in this nation's history where there's an opportunity to enact serious transformative legislation, new laws similar to what we saw in the 1960s as a result of the civil rights movement? And obviously, I'm not talking about New York alone. I'm talking nationally. I'm talking other states as well. What is your view on that?
I do believe that we have reached a tipping point, and I'm exhilarated by it. I would not ever have wanted the pain, the loss, of so many lives, but to see so many people out there protesting and demanding change, and not just change in one area, sweeping change, has moved me. I mean, I'm not a young person. I'm 65 years old, so I was actually around back in the 60s. And so I know how much it's taken. Now, this has been a long time coming. You know, of course, there have been gains over the decades, but we've never seen anything like this before. I've never seen so many Black, brown, and white people out protesting together. This is just really incredible. And I do believe that all across the country, people are seizing the moment to make very critical policy changes, like immediately. And we see that. We see that in, from Minneapolis. We see that in D.C. We see that people are asking for, demanding change, and the powers that be are responding.
The other side of the same question is, we did see the Southern reaction in the 1960s, the backlash, the mm-hmm. Southern strategy that derailed or at least diverted that progressive march, which had begun in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. How do we avoid that repeating itself mm-hmm. this time?
I was speaking to someone yesterday about the backlash, that how we have to prepare for that. It will come. And one of the ways that we do that is to be all around the country, not just here. We do have to form structures, organizations that recognize that this is coming, and figure out ways to make sure that the reforms that we actually achieve are sustainable, and that we have a mechanism to continue communicating with each other about the pushback and about how things are changing on the ground. We have to learn how to be more nimble, how to be adaptable. We cannot go back to the old days when we had one leader, and the leader was shot down, and then we were left bereft of leadership, bereft of a plan. Right. We can't let that happen again. So I encourage anyone who's reading, listening,
New York City's First Lady Charlene McRae spoke with Black Star News editor and WBAI host Milton Alamadi. We'll be right back.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Don't you worry anymore. 'Cause when life looks like easy street, there is danger at your door. Now think this through with me. Let me know your mind. Oh, what I want to know is, are you kind? Now it's a buck dancer's choice, my friend. Better take my advice. You know all the rules by now, and the fire from the ice. Now will you come with me? Won't you come with me? Oh, I want to know, will you come with me? Sister, will I declare, have you seen the like? Their walls are built of cannonballs. Their motto is, don't tread on me. Come here, Uncle John's hand, lay into the tide. Come with me or go alone. He's come to take his children home. Story the crow told me, it's the only one he knows. Like the morning sun you come, and like the wind you go. Ain't no time to hate, barely time to wait. Oh, I want to know, where does the time go? I live in a silver mine, and the beggar's tomb. I got me a violin, and I beg you, call the tune. Anybody's choice, I can hear your voice. Oh, I want to know, how does the song go? Come here, Uncle John's bear by the riverside. Talk about here beside the rising tide. Come here, Uncle John's bear, lay into the tide. Come on, come on, please come to take his children home.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
For Pacifica Radio New York, I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
When I say cancel, you say rent. Cancel! Cancel!
Throughout cancel. New York cancel. State, thousands cancel. Of tenants when and housing cancel, rights advocates came cancel. To the courthouses cancel. Chanting. They took to the streets to stop the housing courts from reopening for the filing of an estimated 50 to 60,000 new eviction proceedings as the pandemic-related moratorium on evictions expired, which will disproportionately hit Black and Brown communities. In Brooklyn, the protesters did shut the court down while demanding that Governor Cuomo extend the moratorium for all New Yorkers and to cancel rent and mortgage payments for the duration of the crisis.
What do we want? Justice!
What do we want?
Now!
What do we want?
Justice!
What do we want?
Now!
What do we want?
Justice!
What do we want?
Now!
Free
Freedom
Matters!
Shut it down!
Free
Freedom Matters!
Shut it down!
How y'all doing? So I'm Adam Bunker Decco. I was born and raised in this city. My parents are two war refugees from Uganda. I grew up in a one-bedroom apartment, one of six, with aunts, uncles, and the like. And guess what? That one-bedroom apartment was $300-some-odd. By the time they had left that one-bedroom, it was $600. They could barely afford it. In our community, in Crown Heights, in Flatbush, in East Flatbush, in Brownsville, people who look like my parents, people who came here from the West Indies, people who came here from Sub-Saharan Africa, can no longer afford to live here. Can no longer afford to live here. They deserve better than this. This place represents what has happened to our Brooklyn. The fact that black and brown people are no longer going to be able to call this place home. And in the next coming days, we're going to have choices to make about what kind of society we should live in. Whether or not government has a responsibility to do more for those who have given their lives to build up this country. And all of us out here have a responsibility to not only support them, but to help them build a country that allows for them to live with dignity. This building has represented them not having dignity. We need not to only cancel evictions, we need to cancel rent in this country. All of you have a choice. All of us have a choice, whether to be silent or whether to do the work. Thank y'all.
Shut it down, support rent strike rally, why it's a matter of life and death. For Pacifica Radio New York, I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy, presented by Pacifica's New York station, WBAI. I'm Gloria J. Brown Marshall, your host. This week, New York Police Department Commissioner Dermot Shea pushed back against testimony from the public about police brutality during recent protests.
He spoke on the third day of hearings conducted by New York Attorney General Letitia James. Her office has been charged by New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo to conduct an independent investigation into the NYPD's actions against recent protesters. The appearance by the NYPD commissioner followed testimony from over 100 witnesses, taking place for 17 hours, broadcast over Pacifica's New York station WBAI. Here's NYPD Commissioner Dermot Shea.
There is no magic bullet, Attorney General. And when you look at what's happening in New York City right now, we have a large amount of people that are involved in gun violence. There's a large amount of people that are put back on the street without adequate safety nets. This is a much larger discussion, in my opinion, than what it usually degenerates into.
But Commissioner, you also understand that there has to be a... Commissioner, you also understand there has to be a level of trust. The police depend upon the general public. And right now, unfortunately, that trust has been harmed as a result of some of the videos that have been shown online. And with that, let me just get to some of the incidents that we continue to see both in the...
Warning. Yep. Can I just say something on trust?
Yeah.
I got to run in a minute or two, but... Our trust has taken a hit. I think you're right. Absolutely. And I think people's patience between this is a year like no other. But to say that no one has trust in the police department, I don't think is accurate either. I think we have to regain some of the trust that we've lost. I think people are afraid right now. And I think it's sad to say that they trust the police. They are saying it to me privately. I'm having elected officials call me up and tell me privately, but no one will come out and support the police right now because they are scared, because they will get shouted down. And I think that's really sad.
I think, Commissioner, this is not an issue of not trusting the police. It's those instances of bad cops who unfortunately engage in misconduct. For instance, the one video that we've seen where a police officer removes a protester's mask and sprays them with pepper spray. Or what about the instance where a police officer made a gesture which appeared to be a white nationalist gesture? Or what about the video where the officer brandished his gun? And we talked a lot about the two cars that mowed into a crowd of peaceful protesters and the video of an officer indiscriminately pepper spraying. It's those videos, unfortunately, Commissioner, that have had an impact on the trust that is needed in order for our police officers to be effective.
Well, I think those incidents, more importantly than that, I think those incidents need to be fully investigated and people to speak the truth about individuals' cases. And when the officers are wrong, they need to be dealt with. There needs to be repercussions. And then that needs to be done swiftly and in a transparent fashion.
But so all the instances I just mentioned, are the officers being disciplined?
It's a combination. And some of those incidents, you mentioned an incident where an officer pointed his gun at the crowd. There is absolutely no discipline in that case. And I think that if you investigate that incident, I would hope that you would agree with me.
Well, in that particular instance, I think his partner or his superior was hit with a bottle, and then he brandished his gun and took and waved it at the crowd. You believe that that's appropriate?
I don't believe you just outlined an accurate recording of the events. You had a long period of time where literally everything but the kitchen sink was being thrown at officers. Officers were being attacked on that corner for a prolonged period of time. The officer, the superior, a lieutenant who was still injured and home, by the way, was cowardly attacked with a brick. It was not a bottle. Smashed down on his head. And this was the incident, that environment, to what the officer was pulling his gun out to. Yes.
And what about the officer who made a hand gesture, which would suggest a white nationalist sign?
I think that should be an offline conversation because I don't think you have the whole story on that.
Okay, and the two cars we discussed earlier, where you thought it was appropriate that the cars can be used to, I guess, clear a road or to mow down peaceful protesters.
I think that couldn't be further, what you just described, from an accurate report.
So how would you describe it?
You or anyone else, what would you do when you are set upon and your life is in danger? And I think that description of running over peaceful protesters, I don't think you're being fair.
And the mask being removed and being sprayed with pepper spray.
Yeah, I believe that discipline was already taken, and I made that public. There was a change of duty status, and discipline is being meted out, and that was completely inappropriate.
NYPD Commissioner Dermot Shea at a hearing into recent brutal interactions between the NYPD and the public, questioned by New York State Attorney General Letitia James. On this week's edition of WBAI's Radio Gag, Gays Against Guns, a reading of the names of those who lost their lives to police brutality.
This is the list of Black lives lost at the hands of the police in the U.S. since Eric Garner's death in July 2014. Eric Garner, John Crawford III, Michael Brown, Ezell Ford, Dante Parker, Michelle Cusso, Laquan McDonald, George Mann, Tanisha Anderson, Akai Gurley, Tamir Rice, Rumain Brisbane, Jeremy Reed, Matthew Ajibadi, Frank Smart, Natasha McKenna, Tony Robinson, Anthony Hill, Maya Hall, Philip White, Eric Harris, Walter Scott, William Chapman II, Alexia Christian, Brendan Glenn, Victor Manuel LaRosa, Jonathan Sanders, Freddie Gray, Joseph Mann, Salvador Ellswood, Sandra Bland, Albert Joseph Davis, Darius Stewart, Billy Ray Davis, Samuel DeBose, Michael Sabe, Brian Keith Day, Christian Taylor, Troy Robinson, Ashams Faro Manley, Felix Kumi, Keith Harrison McLeod, Junior Prosper, Lamontes Jones, Patterson Brown, Dominic Hutchinson, Anthony Ashford, Alonzo Smith, Tyree Crawford, India Kager, Levante Biggs, Michael Lee Marshall, Jamar Clark, Richard Perkins, Nathaniel Harris Pickett, Benny Lee Tigner, Miguel Espinal, Michael Noel, Kevin Matthews, Betty Jones, Quintonio LeGreer, Keith Childress Jr., Janet Wilson, Randy Nelson, Antroni Scott, Wendell Celestine, David Joseph, Colin Roque Moore, Dijon Perkins, Christopher Davis, Marco Loud, Peter Gaines, Tori Robinson, Darius Robinson, Kevin Hicks, Mary Josillo, Demarcus Samir, Willie Tillman, Terrell Thomas, Sylville Smith, Alton Sterling, Belandro Castile, Terrence Crutcher, Paul O'Neill, Alteria Woods, Jordan Edwards, Aaron Bailey, Ronell Foster, Stephen Clark, Antoine Rose II, Botham Jean, Pamela Turner, Dominique Clayton, Atatiana Jefferson, Christopher Whitfield, Christopher McCrory, Eric Reason, Michael Lorenzo Dean, Breonna Taylor, and George Floyd. We remember and honor you.
Silence is a quiet, and it feels like it's getting hard to breathe. And I know you feel like dying, but I promise we'll take the world to its feet. Move mountains, bring it to its feet. That we have each other.
Welcome back, and you're listening to Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy, presented by Pacifica's New York station, WBAI. I'm Gloria J. Brown Marshall, your host. The public has not heard from the White House Coronavirus Task Force in over a month. Finally, this week, there was testimony before the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Here's Dr. Anthony Fauci.
We have a very large country, very heterogeneous, major differences, for example, between the New York metropolitan area and Casper, Wyoming. If you look at how we've been hit badly. I mean, anybody who looks at the numbers, we've had now over 120,000 deaths and we've had 2.5 million infections. So it's a serious situation. In some respects, we've done very well. Right now, for example, the New York metropolitan area, which has been hit extraordinarily hard, has done very well in bringing the cases down and using the guidelines that we have very carefully put together in a stepwise fashion to try and carefully reopen their city and their state. However, in other areas of the country, we're now seeing a disturbing surge of infections that looks like it's a combination. But one of the things is an increase in community spread, where we were going down from 30,000 to 25 to 20, and now we sort of stayed about flat, and now we're going up A couple of days ago, there were 30,000 new infections. That's very troublesome to me. The way you address that, and I've said this over and over again, is you have to have the manpower, the system, the testing to identify, isolate, and contact trace in an effective way so that when you see those increases, you can understand where they're coming from and you can do something about them.
So next we have Mr. Rush from Illinois.
I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for holding this important hearing. When it becomes apparent that institutional racism and structural discrimination are playing a part in why certain racial and ethnic communities are suffering more than white communities.
When you're looking at the African-American community and the minority community in general as a demographic group, there are two elements that make it much more difficult for them and why they're suffering disproportionately. One is the risk of infection. Because of economic and other considerations, the jobs that the majority of them would find themselves in does not allow them to protect themselves by looking into a computer and doing telework. Most of them are essential on outside, having to mingle in a society in which the virus is circulating. So right at the get-go, they have a greater risk of getting infected. And then we know from a lot of experience now that the situation regarding whether or not you have serious consequences, hospitalizations, intubation, complications, and death, relate very strongly to the prevalence and incidence of underlying comorbid conditions, which are clearly disproportionately more expressed in the African-American population than in the rest of the population. And that particularly includes hypertension, diabetes, obesity, chronic lung disease, and kidney disease. So unfortunately, we have a situation where it's sort of a double whammy of a negative capability of them to respond through no fault of their own because of underlying conditions and the conditions in which they find themselves with.
Would you consider racism itself as being one of the stresses that certainly impacts the African American community more in an extraordinary way than contributes to these comorbidities?
Would I consider institutional racism as contributing? No, I don't think there's...
Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Congressman.
Testimony by Dr. Anthony Fauci before the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Dr. Fauci warns that the next few weeks are critical to tamping down a disturbing coronavirus surge across the United States. The lack of testing for those behind bars is another crisis brought to light by COVID-19. Here's Johanna Fernandez.
Protesters in Pennsylvania have now been on a hunger strike for more than 3 weeks. The hunger strikers call their protest the Free People Strike, and it stands in solidarity with incarcerated people. The strike is supported by the Human Rights Coalition, Black Lives Matter Philly, Philly for Real Justice, the Coalition to Abolish Death by Incarceration, and many other organizations. The Free People Strike is continuing its rolling fast each day. Their central demand calls on Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf to immediately release the 1,800 prisoners eligible for release under his April 10th reprieve order. In addition, it calls on the governor to release the 16,000 Pennsylvania prisoners who are over the age of 60 or have been deemed medically vulnerable. We're joined now by Aaron Appel and Ms. Didi, two members of the Free People Strike. Thank you so very much for being on the hunger strike and for amplifying this very important crisis across the country in our prisons. You're pressuring Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf to commit to the urgency of decarceration. What exactly are your demands?
It's actually recommended that many, many, many more people than 1,800 be released. And so we have people incarcerated for drug trafficking offenses, technical violations of parole, medically vulnerable, who just simply can be released very easily. Additionally, we're asking to suspend the sentences for technical violations of parole so that we're not bringing more people inside. In addition, we need to ensure that people who are released have proper reentry resources and supports, and that we're ensuring prevention, access to testing and medical care for those who remain incarcerated. And finally, to issue an emergency removal order on the Berks County Residential Center and release all families who are incarcerated there, because we can't limit this struggle just to the prisons. We need to talk about immigration and detention centers.
And that's an area of incarceration that often gets left out of the conversation. Ms. Titi, why have governors been so resistant to decarceration, especially in this moment of the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, first of all, because they're more interested in other things being open, like the city being opened up, making money for the city. But right now we're having a pandemic where those that are vulnerable should be let go, and they're judging inmates by the crime that they did when they first did the crime at the beginning, when they should be judged by who they are today.
Thank you both so very much for being with us and for the work you do.
I'm Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics and host of Exploration. Sadly, as expected, we're now witnessing a second wave of infections. The rate of hospitalization has spiked in fully half the United States, especially Florida, Texas, and Arizona. However, some people have claimed that this is normal, simply the result of better testing for the virus, so there is nothing to worry about. Unfortunately, the data contradicts this. The recent surge is timed precisely according to the incubation period of the coronavirus and not testing. After being exposed to the virus, symptoms begin to show, on average, 5 days later, and hospitalization usually results about 1 to 2 weeks after that. So the current surge in hospitalization is happening right on schedule, a few weeks after Memorial Day celebrations and the lifting of the national lockdown, so the timing is totally independent of testing for the virus. Now, there's also a glimmer of hope. Two new classes of therapeutics can reduce the deadly effects of the virus. For the first time, in fact, there are therapies which have been tested on thousands of patients with dramatic results. Remdesivir can dramatically reduce the number of days that a person is hospitalized. And dexamethasone is a steroid, which actually reduces the death rate by one-third, which is remarkable. And it is commonly found in hospitals and only costs about $1 a day. So how does it work? This is because the coronavirus does not kill you at all. That's right. Instead, the virus causes your own immune system to overreact. So your own immune system attacks your organs. In some sense, you drown in your own fluids. This is called the cytokine storm. Steroid drugs, which can reduce inflammation, can dampen this deadly overreaction. So being put on a ventilator is not necessarily a death warrant. So even without a vaccine, which may arrive perhaps early next year, scientists are slowly unraveling the genetic secrets of the coronavirus and finding new ways to attack it. For example, scientists are now finding weak spots in the reproduction cycle of the coronavirus. So in other words, one day we may have a cocktail of drugs that precisely hit these weak spots in the reproduction cycle of the coronavirus. For Pacifica National Radio, this is Dr. Michio Kaku.
You've been listening to Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy. This program was produced at WBAI New York by Linda Perry, with Milton Alamadi, Mimi Rosenberg, Johanna Fernandez, Michio Kaku, WPFW, and Radio Gag. I'm your host, Gloria J. Brown Marshall. Thanks for listening. I'll see you on the radio.
COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.